Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for community, life sciences, and workplace clients, on the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Today we look into the history of the National Geographic magazine. It began as a technical journal late in the 19th century. Its readership numbered between 1,000 and 1,500. Today it has millions of readers and reaches people via radio, television, books, films, and the Internet. The success of the Society and the magazine rests largely on the shoulders of one family, one member of whom was Alexander Graham Bell. He was the son-in-law of the Society's founder, Gardner Green Hubbard. He reluctantly took on the project of rescuing the magazine and Society and turning the magazine into a successful enterprise. Bell at the time was occupied with experiments in flight. In fact, our guest today describes Bell as being obsessed with flight. The year was 1898. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Robert Poole. He's a former executive editor of National Geographic. He left the magazine in 2001 to write Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made. Listeners, I invite your questions about the National Geographic Society and its magazine. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to the 21 years Robert Poole spent as a writer and editor at National Geographic, he has written articles for many publications. Prior to joining the National Geographic, he was a newspaper reporter covering national politics and the environment. Robert Poole's book, Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, is published by the Penguin Press. And our guest this afternoon, Robert Poole, will be in the Chicago area next week on the 11th of January. He'll give a lunchtime talk at the Union League Club, and then in the evening, that evening, the 11th of January, he'll give a talk at the Explorers Club. That's Tuesday, January 11th. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Poole, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
The journal that preceded the magazine we know today, would we recognize it?
I don't think so. You might recognize the National Geographic name, but that would be about it. It was very, very dull. Very few illustrations. Very erratically published. They basically, in the earliest days, 1888 to, let's say, 1898, they published the magazine only when they had enough articles to fill it up. And most of the articles were from lectures that members of the National Geographic Society had given in Washington, D.C., mostly scientific lectures, pretty dry stuff.
Yeah. Well, today when we think of the magazine, we think of photographs and maps as an essential accompaniment to the articles. When did those elements become part of the magazine's identity?
Well, this goes to the gentleman you mentioned, the second president of National Geographic, Alexander Graham Bell, who, of course, invented the telephone. And my argument in Explorer's House is that after the telephone, I would say the National Geographic magazine is Bell's second great invention. He's the one who wanted to make the magazine the main reason for the National Geographic Society's being. He's the one who had the idea of making photography an important part of the magazine, and for making maps and good, clear, straightforward, nonpartisan reporting a part of the magazine. So he came forward in 1898, as you suggested, reluctantly. He didn't really want to do it, but the family sort of badgered him into taking over National Geographic and really built it up into the magazine we recognize today.
Yeah. He was reluctant to take it over, but when he did, he took it over with great gusto. He had great ideas for articles for the journal. Maybe you'd give us some examples of some of the suggestions he had for the man who was his son-in-law, who was then in charge of the magazine.
Yes. Well, Bill was he was an erratic genius. He was interested in everything. He read as many newspapers and magazines as he could lay his hands on. He just was reading all the time, learning all the time, and he was very much interested in current affairs, in science, in natural history, in just about everything. So I think you can, if you look at the magazine today, you can trace this back to Bell's omnivorous interest. This young editor he hired in 1899 was named Gilbert M. Grosvenor, and Grosvenor became Bell's son-in-law. Bell knew himself well enough to know that he himself would not have time to run a magazine like National Geographic, so he found an energetic, hard-working young school teacher named Gilbert Grosvenor and bombarded him with ideas for the magazine. And luckily for everyone, Gilbert H. Grosvenor took those ideas into print each month. Bell, just in a matter of reading the correspondence between Bell and Gilbert Grosvenor while I was doing research for this book, I was just amazed at the range of Bell's interest. In the space of a two-week period, he would propose stories on Abyssinia, yellow fever, malaria, earthquakes in Spain, the Indian Ocean, tsunamis, just on and on. He was interested in everything, and fortunately, he chose very, very well in this young 25-year-old school teacher, Gilbert Grosvenor, who became the action officer for Bell, the idea man. And I think you could argue that if it had not been for their peculiar and for us, a providential combination of talents, I don't think the magazine would have succeeded. We probably wouldn't be talking about it.
Mm. Do you think Bell would have made a good newspaperman?
I think he would have been a great newspaperman.
Yeah.
just because he was interested in everything. And in fact, the motto he came up for, the marching orders he came up with for Gilbert Grosvenor, National Geographic, was as follows, quote, "The world and all that is in it is our theme, and if we can't find something in that to interest people, we'd better shut up shop." So, yes, I think in terms of interest and in terms of writing ability and reporting ability, Bell would have been a great newspaper man, but he may have been a little too erratic, even for that business, which is known to attract some erratic people from time to time.
The Society, let's go back in time now a little bit to when the Society was founded in 1888. Tell us about the founding father, who was Bell's father-in-law, and the first members of the Society, and what their vision for the Society was.
Yes, well, the organizing group for National Geographic was just this amazing group of characters. You cast your mind back to 1888, the post-Civil War years in Washington, D.C. Washington is just now turning from a small village because of the war. It's built up. It's becoming a city. And most important for our story is that it's becoming a city obsessed with science and modernizing this young nation. science was very important, especially government-sponsored science, so that you see at this time agencies like the U.S. Geological Survey really growing, really getting big, and attracting characters like John Wesley Powell, Major John Wesley Powell, who was a Civil War veteran who had explored the length of the Colorado River by boat. That almost killed him, but he survived that. And then he went on to direct the surveying much of the western part of the United States. He also helped to establish the Bureau of Ethnology as a government bureau. The U.S. Weather Bureau is starting up. There are people obsessed with studying weather, with studying climate, with measuring things and trying to use science to lift the country up and make it modern, make it better. And so that all of these people are coalescing in Washington, these people who are interested in science, and especially government-sponsored science. Anyway, they all know each other. The town's still small enough for everybody to know everyone else. And they met occasionally at a place called the Cosmos Club, which is a block from the White House. And they would sit around and talk about their explorations in the western U.S. or in Siberia or in Alaska, which was still sort of a blank spot, and basically just sort of trade stories. Out of this group grew the National Geographic Society. They wanted to have some sort of formal mechanism for giving lectures, for getting together, for meeting periodically to talk about their adventures. And the organizing man of this group and the first president of the National Geographic Society was this gentleman you mentioned, Gardner Green Hubbard, who was Bell's father-in-law. He was a lawyer from Boston. And he basically came to Washington to organize the Bell Telephone Company and to defend Bell's claim to the patent for the telephone. The patent office was in Washington, D.C., and a lot of the litigation challenging Bell's claim to the telephone arose in Washington. So that's how the family moved from Boston to Washington, and that's how Gardner Green Hubbard came to be here and was in place to start the National Geographic Society.
Yeah. Well, underlying this story is the story of a family. The story of the National Geographic is largely a story of family, five generations. And we begin with Gardner Green Hubbard and Mabel Hubbard and one of their daughters, Mabel. Or, no, I have the names wrong here, don't I?
No, you have it just right.
That's Do I?
The
okay.
Other daughter is Mabel Hubbard, Gardner Hubbard's daughter.
Okay. And Gardner's Hubbard's wife name, though?
She was Gertrude.
Gertrude. Okay. That's yes. That's where my mind slipped. But Mabel is how Alexander Graham Bell comes into this story. And Mabel and Alec are a remarkable couple. They had a most interesting courtship. Just maybe you'd tell us just a little bit about how they met and how they fell in love.
Yes, the story of National Geographic is, as you suggest, a family story, and therefore, from one generation to the next, right through till recent times, there's a romance involved. And that's certainly the case with Mabel Hubbard and Alexander Graham Bell. Mabel Hubbard, when she was 5 years old, contracted scarlet fever, which today we would call strep throat. But back then, there was really no treatment for it, and a lot of children in the 1860s and 70s died from it. Mabel almost died. She was very, very sick for a long time. She did survive, but as often happened with scarlet fever, the infection went into her ears, and it made her deaf. She was deaf for the rest of her life. This is what led her, this terrible crisis, as often happens in life, led to something good, and that something good was Alexander Graham Bell in Mabel's case. Bell was a young man. He was 26 years old at the time. He was living in Boston, and he was teaching oratory at Boston University. He was also teaching deaf students to speak, to read, to write, and he was just almost instantly an overnight sensation in the community of deaf people because he was so great with teaching these students. Mabel Hubbard's family heard about Bell, of course, and Mabel became a student of Alexander Graham Bell. He was, as I said, in his mid-20s. She was now 17, so there was quite an age spread between them. And Bell instantly fell in love with this student. And the same was not true of Mabel. She thought Bell was sort of a clod and clumsy, and she didn't like the way he dressed. She didn't like the way he looked. Eventually she came around and they were married, and that's how the families of Hubbard and Bell got started.
Yeah. You know, when I think of Alexander Graham Bell, I think of this larger-than-life man, eccentric, enthusiastic, a lot of spirit. Clearly in the story that you tell here in Explorer's House, he loved his daughters and his 10 grandchildren. But early in the story, you point out, he had a tendency all his life for solitude. This came as a big surprise to me. A tendency, you say, that threatened to cut him off from society. What can you tell us about that?
Well, he was a complex character, and it's true what you say. He was, when he was in public, when he was with the family, or when he was making a speech, meeting people, he was ebullient, he was happy, he was outgoing. He was one of the most engaging characters of the Gilded Age, no question about it. But he had this almost pathological need to be alone much of the time, just so that he could think things over, read, smoke his pipe, make sketches in his notebooks. He really, really needed this time. And the only way he could manage it, to have the solitude that he felt he needed to be creative, was to stay up all night most nights. He was a night owl, so he would organize his days so that he got up very late in the morning. He had a big pile of newspapers, magazines by the bed, and he would either read them or have someone read them to him. One of the grandchildren or children or someone in the family, or maybe even his secretary, would read it to him from the papers as he had his breakfast. And he would meet with the family. He would talk to whoever happened to come by in the morning. Then as the afternoon wore on, he would go to one of his laboratories where he had different experiments going. And he always had four or five different projects going at one time. He might have a project on genetics going in one laboratory, flight experiments going in another, National Geographic things going in another area. He knew himself well enough to know that if he didn't organize things very, very strictly, he'd get off the tracks and never accomplish anything. So he figured out this way to organize his time and organize his life. And he would come back and have dinner with the family at 5 or 6 in the evening. And he loved playing the piano. He would play the piano. The family would gather around and sing with him. And then he would disappear for the night. And that was the pattern he established. The only real serious arguments that he ever had with his wife, Mabel Hubbard Bell, was over this pattern. She did not understand why he had to do this, why he had to be alone at night and spend so much time alone. But he did, and they just managed it as best they could.
Mm. As we mentioned earlier, he, despite his reluctance, he yielded to the wishes of his mother-in-law, Gertrude, following her husband's death, his father-in-law's death, Gardner Hubbard's death. And here I'd like you to speculate, if you wouldn't mind. Had Bell kept to his flight experiments, do you think he could have beaten the Wrights into the air in 1903?
I don't. That's a good question. I don't think so. Who knows? I mean, it's impossible to say. But I think Bell was interested in flight to a great degree. But I think a lot of his interest had to do with a very, very good friend of his named Samuel P. Langley, who was Secretary of the Smithsonian, who really got the first motorized airplanes into the air. They weren't—they didn't have people in them. But his friend Langley and he would go out. They'd go down on the Potomac River and send these models up over the river, big models, just see how they flew. Langley was ahead of the Wrights, and he was ahead of Bell. Tragically for Langley, he tried two manned flights in the winter of 1903. Unfortunately for him, there was a huge contingent of reporters watching as his plane took off, and it just got up over the Potomac River, caught on a catapult from which they launched the plane and crashed into the river. And it really, because there were so many reporters there, because it got so much coverage, his hopes for being first in the air sort of died. And, of course, less than 2 weeks later, the Wright brothers were first to get successfully into the air. Bell sort of, I think that what happened with Bell was that he really got serious about flight after Langley's failure and after the Wrights got their planes up in the air. Bell, I believe, did it out of his own interest, but also in some sort of tribute to one of his best friends, Samuel Langley, who died of a broken heart, according to Bell, after his failure at flight.
Hmm. Robert Poole is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him this afternoon about the National Geographic Society and the National Geographic Magazine. The magazine began as a technical journal of the society late in the 19th century, and its readership numbered, a few hundred at the beginning, and then it grew to 1,500, then dropped to 1,000. Today, of course, as we all know, it has millions of readers, and it reaches people via all kinds of other media. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Robert Poole. He's a former editor at National Geographic. He's the author of Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So Alec Bell and his son-in-law, Bert Grosvenor, are now faced with trying to build this fledgling organization and its journal. And they really need to broaden the base of subscribers. How did they go about approaching that problem?
Well, it was quite original, I think, their approach to this problem. First of all, and I think importantly, Bell lowered the membership dues from $5 a year to $2 a year, just because he wanted to reach people not just in Washington but all over the United States. So that's the first thing they did. They shot the dues down to a reasonable, approachable level. The other thing they did, which is really original, and this shows you how Bell's mind worked, I think they began what was probably one of the first, if not the first, direct mail campaigns in magazine history. Gilbert Grosvenor, at Bell's encouragement, got mailing lists from the American Association for the Advancement of Science, from the National Education Association, from Phi Beta Kappa, he got lists of Army and Navy officers, nationwide lists. And then he sat down, Bert Grosvenor sat down and wrote personal letters to everyone on all of those lists and had Alexander Graham Bell sign the letters. Or another prominent founder of the Geographic magazine, Adolphus W. Greely, who was a great Arctic explorer, very well known to many people at the time. So anyway, they started sending these letters out, and the membership gradually built up by the hundreds, by the thousands, and ultimately by the 10,000s through this direct mail method, in which Alexander Graham Bell invited other scientists, other people who were interested in exploration, to become members of the National Geographic Society. Nobody did own or has ever owned the National Geographic Society. It's a membership organization, and I believe one reason it's been successful over the years is that all of the money that has come in from membership dues and other sources, mainly membership dues, has gone back into operations. There were never any stockholders, never anybody trying to get rich off of the magazine. And I think that is that goes back to this sort of high-minded, altruistic attitude that Alexander Graham Bell had about the purposes of the National Geographic Society and what it ought to do and how it ought to be truly educational, nonpartisan, and scientific operation, but organized so that it would appeal to a mass audience.
At the same time, there were worries in the early days about unwanted members.
Yes, and this is a something that I address in the book. I don't think this really came from Bell. Bell was pretty. I don't see any evidence of it until Bell, after Bell dies in 1923. But what you say is true. In the early days, the National Geographic Society did not welcome people of color. They didn't really have a campaign against them, but I think that the people who were running National Geographic were afraid that black people might show up at lectures in Washington, D.C., at Geographic lectures, or they might come by to use the library. And the people, unfortunately, who were running National Geographic in those days just did not want that to happen. And I discovered doing research for this book that there was an active policy to exclude blacks if they could, if the people running the magazine could establish the race of the member applying for membership, the person applying for membership. They did exclude them from membership. This policy was followed, at least in the Washington area, for Washington area members until, I believe, in the late 40s, at which time the President Truman ordered the desegregation of the armed forces. It wasn't until after that that National Geographic really became desegregated.
Over the course of the 20th century, what were the magazine's greatest moments?
Well, I would have to say the best thing National Geographic did was to identify and sponsor some of the great explorers and scientists that we remember from the 20th century. The first of these was Robert Peary. He got the first grant that National Geographic ever gave anybody for exploration. He got $1,000 in 1906, which led Peary to claim that he had reached the North Pole in 1909, first person to the pole. That claim has been challenged, but in any event, Peary's name is associated with National Geographic, and National Geographic's name associated with him. They helped each other out. Of course, there's also Jacques Cousteau, whose early expeditions on the Calypso were supported and very, very much publicized by National Geographic. The Leakey family, a great family of paleontologists in Africa, through three, now four generations, have had sponsorship from National Geographic, and that has extended just as the National Geographic family has extended from one generation to the next. So too with the Leakeys. Bob Ballard, who discovered the Titanic some years ago and has done other significant deep underwater exploration, has been sponsored by National Geographic. Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, all of these people you think of when you think of exploring and science and, you know, going out into the world, those have all been people sponsored by National Geographic. A significant thing National Geographic did in 1910 1863 was to sponsor the first American expedition to Everest, which got not only the first American to the top of Everest, 1963, but also four others made it to the top that year. Four other Americans made it to the top that year, including a National Geographic writer and photographer named Barry Bishop, who lost all of his toes to frostbite on that expedition and remained a National Geographic staff member for many, many years after that.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question regarding the subtitle of your book, National Geographic and the World It Made. How has the National Geographic helped shape our view of the world?
Well, I think it has. It's done so many things to influence how people view the world. I think largely for the good, and I think like a lot of the things that have held up at National Geographic, this comes to us by way of Alexander Graham Bell. He had this great optimistic, high-minded attitude about life and the world and all that is in it. He really wanted to celebrate what a great, wonderful place the world is, and I think that's what he set out to do for National Geographic, with National Geographic, to celebrate other cultures, to celebrate the beauty of the world, but also to provide people with crucial, reliable geographical information at important times in history. One of the biggest jumps in National Geographic membership came in 1914. At the outbreak of World War I, National Geographic had, when the war broke out, 200,000 maps of Europe ready to go. They could see war was coming. They knew that people would want to follow the war news, you know, on the radio or in the newspapers on detailed, accurate, reliable maps. So that this established a pattern for National Geographic of providing good, solid information to help people understand what's going on in the world at the time it's going on. I'm sure that there will be, even though this recent tsunami has been very well covered in the daily press and radio on television, I'm sure that National Geographic will have something several months hence to contribute to better understanding, deeper understanding of what this tsunami was and how it worked and how it fits in with other events like that.
Mm. You mentioned the First World War. What was the magazine like in the Second World War and through the Cold War?
Well, the magazine has done a great job of celebrating the world and calling attention to, let's say, our better moments in human history. They've been less successful at least until recently, at covering the realities, the grim realities of life in the 20th century. Because they didn't really want to be too critical of other countries, National Geographic essentially ignored the Soviet Union through much of the 20th century. And through the early part of the Cold War, they knew that, and this goes largely to Gilbert H. Grosvenor, Burt Grosvenor, Bell's son-in-law. Burt Grosvenor had been to Russia before the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. He had gone there after the revolution, and he didn't like what he saw. He thought it was not good. He thought it was very messy. I think it somehow offended his sense of order. And because he knew that National Geographic couldn't say anything positive about this new country, the biggest country in the world then, the Soviet Union, National Geographic just ignored it for most of the 20th century.
Do you think he, Burt Grosvenor, had... he didn't like conflict, it seems to me. And I wonder if, you know, in the way that he handled the controversy over the race to reach the North Pole, it comes through there. And then when he first joined the magazine, he had some rough moments and more than moments, actually. Here again, we're just speculating, but Maybe briefly, you'd care to comment on that?
No, I think that's a great observation. I think he didn't like controversy. He didn't like conflict, even within his own family. When one of his he had seven children. He had a big family. When one of his children criticized someone else, family member or someone else, he would admonish them for saying something unpleasant about another person. And I think he did carry that through to the personality of National Geographic magazine. And that gets back to what we were discussing earlier. I think National Geographic, just like the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, in some way reflects this accretion of the personalities that have shaped it and built it up and made it what it is over time, so that I certainly discovered in my book, when I was working on my book, that there are all these things that National Geographic does today, these attitudes that it has, that you can almost trace back every one to an individual in the Bell or Grosvenor families.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Robert Poole, our guest this afternoon, author of Explorer's House, National Geographic, and the World It Made. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Arcola. Hi.
Hi. I've been enjoying all of the talk about your book and so forth. I did have a question about the National Geographic. Supposedly they were doing a travel guide for the United States, and I tried finding out about it, but never. I even called and talked to several different departments at one point in time, and never found what I was, you know, where it was, or who did it, or where it was available. Do you have any idea if they've done a United States travel?
I don't know of a particular travel guide, but I believe that the book department at National Geographic has done a series of regional travel guides.
Mm-hmm.
That may be what you have in mind, but if you want to leave your telephone number offline or your email address, I'll be happy to follow up on it, try to put you in touch with the right person.
Wonderful. I would like that very much, and I did appreciate the idea that they were doing even more with the United States. Even, you know, I know they've gone beyond and into the far reaches of the world, but I really liked the idea that they were going to do more on the United States.
Yeah, I think there's some form of that going on. I just don't know. I've been away from there for a few years, so I don't know specifically what's going on, but I'll certainly try to find out and help you with that information.
Wonderful.
Okay, so listener, hang on, and Jason Croft, our director, will get that information from you, and we'll pass it on to Robert Poole. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we talked about we've talked quite extensively about this period of expansion and where the National Geographic that we have today sort of came to life. But since then, in recent years, in recent decades, as I mentioned in my introduction some time ago, the National Geographic now reaches us through radio, television, books, films, the internet. It's available to people who speak other languages. When did that begin to take shape?
Well, this started, we've talked about, I believe, the first three members of this family, representing three different generations, Gardner Hubbard, Alexander Graham Bell, and Gilbert H. Grosvenor. The real expansion, the real jump in, let's call it diversifying National Geographic, came in 1957 when Gilbert H. Grosvenor's son, Melville Bell Grosvenor, became editor and president of National Geographic. Melville had been at National Geographic since the 1920s. He'd spent all of his life there as a young editor. Now, by the time he took over, he was 56 years old. His father, I think, really enjoyed his work so much. He was editor. Gilbert H. Grosvenor was editor from 1899 until 1954. He didn't really want to give up the job. And he also didn't entirely trust Melville to take over. Fathers can sometimes know their sons too well. Maybe they don't give them credit for, you know, having something on the ball. But in any event, Melville finally got his chance at age 56 in 1957. And he hit the ground running. He had decided that National Geographic Society needed to be more than just National Geographic magazine, which until that time was pretty much all National Geographic had been. It existed almost solely to produce this this wonderful, well-known, much-beloved magazine. Melville wanted to go beyond that. So in a very, very short period, Melville took National Geographic into television. He produced the first television documentary from that 1963 Everest expedition I mentioned earlier. Mm. Not only did they have mountaineers on Everest that year, they also had camera crews there filming this for the first television documentary at National Geographic, which of course led to many, many years and many award-winning documentaries that National Geographic has produced. Melville also wanted to do atlases. He produced the first National Geographic Atlas of the world. He produced the first books. The National Geographic Book Division was established under Melville. And most important, I think, he brought in new editors, new writers, new photographers, and tried to bring in a lot of fresh energy to National Geographic. He was very, very much like his grandfather, Alexander Graham Bell. He was ebullient. He loved life. He was interested in everything. He said, I need young people around me. And then he proceeded to hire all of these editors and writers who would take National Geographic into the great growth years of the 1960s and 70s for the organization. So that is when, with Melville Grosvenor, National Geographic got beyond just doing a magazine and started doing many, many, many other things.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get another call or two in here before we have to wrap up. Line one, listener in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I would just like to comment on the recent changes I've seen in National Geographic magazine. Back in the early 90s, well, in more than 5 years ago, they used to have a lot more, articles with maps and things that kind of explain some of the conflicts in the world. Like in 1992, they had an excellent issue on Yugoslavia. Of course, they predicted Kosovo would be the melting pot or the meltdown area. But, you know, they would have maps that would show where the different ethnic people were and kind of explain the conflicts. And in the last couple of years, I feel like the magazine has gotten away from some of that kind of stuff, the geographical kind of stuff, and more into really sensational kind of articles on the environment and things like that. And, you know, after 16 years as a member, I've just stopped reading it. So I don't know if you can comment on that, but that was my comment.
Okay.
Yes, well, I think you make a good point. It sounds as if the problem began about the time I left National Geographic. I'm just kidding, but I think there is an effort to still do the in-depth sort of pieces, especially the kind of map stories and the in-depth stories on trouble spots. There was recently a piece on terrorist areas where there are concentrations of terrorists in the world, a map story. There have been stories recently on human slavery, on oil resources, issues that are very much in the news these days. But I think that it does strike me that the caller has a point, that there is there's less editorial material inside the well of the magazine in recent years, and there has been an increase in more columns and shorter pieces and more, let's call it lightweight stuff, front and back. So perhaps that is a certain lightening of what used to be a more substantial editorial package.
Hmm. Well, I would imagine that the magazine has, you know, it has changed so much over the years, and I imagine that it's difficult to know where next to take it. And interesting comment from the caller. We're going to have to wrap up here, I'm sorry to say. Got another caller we won't be able to take this afternoon. Mr. Poole, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest this afternoon, Robert Poole, will be in Chicago next week on the 11th of January for a lunchtime talk at the Union League Club, and then in the evening on the 11th at 6 o'clock, an evening talk at the Explorers Club. The Union League Club event is set for 11 a.m. Central Time. So if you're in the Chicago area, if you're listening up that way, you might want to look into those events. And I'm sure if you give the Union League Club, forgive me, or the Explorers Club a call, they can give you the information that you would need. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Robert Poole, former executive editor of National Geographic. He is the author of Explorers House, National Geographic, and the World It Made. The book is published by the Penguin Press. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, it was a higher day across the grains floor today. Wheat was up 8 cents, the corn up 7 cents in the nearby March contract, and the January beans were up seven as well. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of Agrivisor Services in Bloomington, Illinois, at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock Central Time. That's coming up in just a few minutes about why this happened. Let's start in the wheat pit, where the March contract today had a 308.5 high, the low at 299.75. The settlement price there at 308.25. Up 8.5 cents. May contract 315.75, the high. Low at 307. Settlement price 315.5. They were up 8.25. In July futures, 322.5, the high. The low at 314.5. Settlement price at 322.25, up 8.25. In September, a 329 high. Low at 322. Settlement price at 328.5, up 7.75 for the day. December futures, 338.5, the high. The low at $3.30.5. Settlement price at 337.75. And they were up 8.25. We'll definitely ask on the technical side what it means that the wheat pit has managed to come back from below $3 and close the following day up around about 8.5 cents in that nearby March contract. And I'm sure Dan will have something to say about that. March corn now 209.5, the high today. Low at 202.5. Settlement price 208.75. They were up 7.25 on the day. May futures 217, the high. The low at 210.25. Settled 216, up 6.75. In July futures, 222.75 high, low at 217.5. Settled there at 222.25, up 5.75 for the day. September futures in the corn pit now, 229.5, the high, the low at 224.75. Settled 229.25, up 5.25. And the December contract, 238.25 high, low at 234. Settled 238, up 4.75. March corn, 245, the high, the low at 241.25. Settlement price at 244.75, up 4.25. May oats, or rather March oats for the day, 162 the high, the low at 157.5. A settlement price at 162, they were up 4.5 cents. And the May, 158.75 high, low at 155. Settlement price at 158.75, up 3.75. January soybeans, 542.5, the high, the low at 535.5. A settlement price 7.75 cents higher in the January beans. They were up up 7.75 at $5.41.75. That the January settlement price. March contract now 533.5, the high, the low at 526. Settlement price 532.5, up 5.5 cents for the day. and the May futures. A 537 high, low at $5.30 and a half cents. Settlement price at 536 and a quarter, up 5 and a quarter for the day. July futures 543 and a half, the high, the low at 536 and a half, a settlement price at 542 and a half. They were up 5 and a quarter. And the August, a 544 high, low at 540, settled up on that high at $5.44 a bushel in the August contract, 4 cents higher for the beans. September futures, 545 the high, the low at 542, settled 544, up 4 and 3 quarters. And next year's November, for the new crop, the high 553, the low at 545 and a half. November beans settled 552 and a half, and they were up 4 and a quarter today. January bean meal now, 157 the high, the low at 155.30. Settled 156.90, up 160, and the March contract, 158.50 high, low at 156.20, settled 157.60. They were up $1.70 for the day. January bean oil, 2010, the high, the low at 19.91, settlement price at $20.08, up 14. And the March oil, 2025 high, low at 20.01, settled 20.17, and they were up a dime for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, thank you very much. Cattle finished lower today. Hogs were mostly higher. January feeder cattle, 104.10 the high, 102.60 the low, 103.20 the settlement, that down 95. March feeders, 98.75 the high, 97.05 the low, the settlement 97.77 and a half, that down 72 and a half. April feeder cattle, 97.65 the high, 96.15 the low, 96.85 the settlement, that down 80. February live cattle, 89.77 and a half the high, 87.40 the low, 88.35 the settlement, that down 105. April, 87.65 the high, 85.65 the low, finishing at 86.65, that down 75. February lean hogs, 76.97 and a half the high, 74.90 the low, 75.80 the settlement, that up a nickel. April lean hogs, 77.05 the high, 75.70 the low, 76.62 and a half the settlement, that down 15. May, 75.80 the high, 74.50 the low, 75.77 and a half the settlement, that up 42 and a half. June lean hogs, 77.90 the high, 76.65 the low, 77.72 and a half the settlement, that finishing up 20. And February bellies, 95.70 the high, 93.72 and a half the low, the settlement 95.10, that up 115. The Dow is up 47 points at 10,645. The NASDAQ 8 higher at 2099. The S&P 500 up 6 at 1190.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science.